welcome, dear listeners, wherever you're from. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Henrik, and I hope you're doing well today. RedIceCreations.com and RedIceMembers.com. That's our websites where you will find a lot more. We are based out of Sweden, and we love to examine things that our governmental system and educational apparatus never discussed, much less considered and implemented. Since it's a state so deeply entrenched in social planning and astronomical public spending, among the highest in the world, actually, we really as a nation need to begin to look elsewhere for alternative systems and things that haven't been tried to get out of the cultural and economic decline that we've been in since our economic crash, especially in the early 90s, but it does go back much further than that. If you're new to this material, or if you haven't heard about the Swedish model of economics and politics before, that is being promoted in the world right now as a more socially fair model, well, then I recommend that you check out our Sweden page, where we have collected all the shows that we've done so far on this topic. It's linked up in our radio archive, and we've done this so that people who are champions of the Nordic model, the type of socialism that you've seen, the third way kind of politics that you've seen in Sweden, who thinks that that's the greatest idea ever without actually having lived under those conditions, we recommend that you, especially you, go and check out the shows that we've done on Sweden and the interviews with people from the inside, if you will, who has a extraordinary perspective on these things, and I think could add a tremendous amount of valuable information to you so that you can make good decisions as to what type of political system you want to favor in the future. So what are some of the other options, some of the things that we haven't tried before? That's what I'm interested in, and that's what we're going to discuss today. So Walter Block is with us. He is an Austrian school economist and anarcho-libertarian philosopher and professor of economics at Loyola University, New Orleans, and senior fellow with the Ludwig von Mises Institute. He is an author, editor, and co-editor of many books, and Block has written more than 500 articles for various non-referred journals, magazines, and newspapers. So Walter is back with us today to discuss the exceptional ideas never tried before of a true free market. Well, welcome back, Walter. Very nice to speak to you again. I hope you've been doing well since we last spoke. Thank you for coming back again.
Always my pleasure.
Excellent. So what I wanted to do today is to, once again, if you will, go over what a free market would potentially mean within society. This is a topic that we have to return to, I think, time and time again. As I learn more and more, I understand how many, you know, misconceptions there are out there. And I've also noticed that a lot of people who don't understand what we have today is actually not a free market. It's not really a true capitalism, but, you know, crony capitalism with government regulation, corporate welfare, etc. But it seems like a lot of people then continue to blame the free market and what they believe is unregulated corporations, you know, for the state of the economy and everything else. And I think that this is very important to get more into this topic as we begin to understand more of it. And you're very articulate and explain things very well as well, Walter. So how would you explain what the free market really is as opposed to what we have today, Walter?
Well, thanks. You're very kind to make those points about me. I hope I can live up to that. The free market or the free enterprise system or laissez-faire capitalism is the moderate view would be that government has a very, very limited role. Its only role is to protect persons and property. It would have armies and to defend us against foreign bad guys, not to have military bases all over the world. I think we've got 1,000 military bases in 160 countries. That's not defense, that's offense. So the role of government would be very limited. It would be in foreign policy, a gigantic, very powerful Coast Guard to make sure nobody messes with us. Economics, again, the role of government, and I'm giving you the moderate view of libertarianism right now,
right,
would be to protect persons and property rights. So, for example, there would be laws against murder and rape and theft and carjacking and things like that, assault and battery. And that would be pretty much what the police would try to stop. They wouldn't try to stop victimless crimes like adults putting marijuana into their bodies or engaging in consenting sexual behavior like prostitution or drugs. There'd be no crime drugs, prostitution, gambling, all that would be legal, which doesn't mean that we libertarians favor these things. Many libertarians, such as myself, oppose them, but we also oppose prohibiting them.
Yeah.
And on economics, there would be just consenting adult behavior again. You know, the lefties are always saying you're going to have consenting adult behavior. But what about capitalist acts between consenting adults, as Robert Nozick once said? That too should be legalized. So you wouldn't have any, rent controls or minimum wages or tariffs or taxes would be very, very low, just sufficient to support the government in promoting these ideals. And that would be pretty much the free enterprise system, a system not unrelated to what the founding fathers of the United States started, except for, of course, slavery. And there were a few other deviations from this philosophy. But we would move back the clock, not in terms of technology or anything like that, God forbid, but just in terms of government would have a very small carbon footprint or a very small footprint, it would just uphold law and order, and that would be it.
Very good. Now, as I proceed here, and just you said this as well, of course, that there are, you know, you're presenting kind of the moderate view here. I know that there's a lot of people, you know, with difference of opinion. They differ quite a bit. So this is by no means kind of, you know, standardized, if you will. But as we proceed, my questioning is, it will be in the context of what would be ideal, I guess, if we were in a free market, so people can kind of get an idea of how it might work. But let's say I wanted to start a company, a corporation in a free market, and how would that work in such a system as opposed to today, then, when we have things like, you know, limited liability companies, we have corporate personhood, you know, these are really inventions of government to protect companies like they were, you know, flesh and blood people with rights and everything else. But how would these things ideally exist within a free market, do you think, Walter?
Well, here I think we might have a little bit of a disagreement, because I don't think that limited liability corporations necessarily violate rights, although they certainly do in today's context. But look, suppose I said, look, I'm going to open up a new company to sell bicycles, to just pick something out of the hat, to mix my metaphors. And I say I'm going to deal with you, but I'm going to deal with you on this basis that if I renege on any contract that I have with you, you can only sue for the amount of money that I've got in the corporation. You can't come after my private estate, such as it is. And if you agree to deal with me on that basis, well, then fine. Now, if I take my bicycle and I ram it into an innocent person, and now the innocent person has got all sorts of health problems, and because of me ramming into the bicycle, even by accident, if I rammed into him, I'd be a criminal. But let's say I accidentally hit him, and now he sues me for $20,000, and I've only got $10,000 in the corporation. Well, now I'm liable for the full amount. He can come after me personally, not just the corporation. But if I have a contract with, let's say with you, I'm selling bicycles or I'm buying tires or whatever it is, and you agree to not sue me for anything more than is in my corporate kitty, and let's say I'm not lying about that, well, I don't see that would be impermissible. And I think that the corporate structure is a reasonable structure. We have partnerships, we have co-ops, we have all sorts of structures, and I think the corporate structure is okay.
Now, let's see if we can clear some of the other things off the table here, if you will. Would there be taxes under a free market?
Well, in the limited government situation that I've outlined, with limited government, and the people who advocate that are people like Ayn Rand or Ron Paul, there would be taxes. They would be very, very low. Milton Friedman once mentioned 10% of the GDP, as opposed to about, I don't know, almost half the GDP. So there would be taxes. But again, this is the limited government vision of libertarianism, not the anarcho-capitalism or anarchist version. And here the taxes would be very, very low, maybe 10% or below. And So there would be taxes, and they would only go for armies, courts, and police. And you'd have to have courts. That would be the third function of government. I forgot to mention that. In addition to protecting us against foreign bad guys and local bad guys, the government would have courts to determine who are the bad guys. Like, for example, if you and I have a commercial disagreement over my bicycle store, and you sue me or I sue you, well, then the court would decide who was the guilty party and who owed who what. And in order to have armies, courts, and police, you'd have to have some taxes. So yes, there would be taxes in this vision. Of course, in the anarchist vision of libertarianism, there'd be no taxes.
Yeah.
And here, even armies, courts, and police would all be privatized. And that would be a much more radical vision of this kind of philosophy.
Do you think that would work?
Oh, yes. I'm of the anarchist persuasion.
Yeah.
I just started off with the lesser radical vision because maybe a lot of people listening in haven't heard of this and might be put off by that. But that certainly is my view, that the government is per se an evil because it violates the one libertarian axiom or principle, non-aggression. And it says that the only proper way to treat each other, the only civilized way to treat each other, is in a voluntary basis. And taxes are not voluntary. They're coercive. People are forced to pay them, whether they like it or not. And they didn't agree. They didn't sign any social contract or anything like that. Government is not like a club. Taxes are not like club dues. You know, you join the chess club or the tennis club, you pay dues. But nobody agreed to join this club called the U.S. government club. There is no such thing. It's a violation of rights. So the anarchist version or the anarcho-capitalist version would be even these functions should be privatized. My motto here is if it moves, privatize it, and if it doesn't move, privatize it. And since everything either moves or doesn't move, we privatize everything, and we would have private armies, private police, private courts. And indeed, each and every one of these things at one time did function. So it's a bit much to chew if you're coming to this de novo, so to speak, if you've never heard of the libertarian vision. So perhaps we should stick more to the limited government vision because there might be a lot of newcomers here and we don't want to put them all off.
Well, we'll go there in due time. We'll cover as much as we can here. And as I said before, you do that very well, Walter, again. So we were going to proceed here and tackle some of these issues along the way as they come up. But I don't think I would be too far off the mark when I said that there are a lot of people then that would be afraid of an unregulated market in that way, because they think we would get more of the same that we have today, you know, corruption, you know, bailouts, irresponsible people, you know, pillaging the earth, etc. And I do want to talk more about the environmental aspect of this later. But I would say that it's true that we can never per se prevent bad people from being in the world, if you will. But the question would be, how could we keep bad, you know, quote unquote, bad people at bay within a free market system? You know, I'm talking about those who are taking advantage of the government as it exists today, and they make sure that they, you know, end up taught by lobbying government in the way that they see fit to gain from it. But how would that work, do you think?
Well, I think I'd like to approach this in sort of in a double-edged way. One, how would we stop bad guys, murderers, rapists, thieves, like that? And also, how would we stop crony capitalists, people who want to be bailed out? Let me start with the second one first. Crony capitalism or welfare corporate capitalism or fascism or whatever you want to call it needs a government that has many more powers than the limited government. In other words, let's take Detroit. Detroit was doing pretty poorly. They were going bankrupt. The automobile companies in Detroit, the city of Detroit is also falling apart, but for different reasons. But let's just take the automobile companies and the bailout there, or the bailout of Wall Street and the banks. There could be no bailout with the limited government because the government would have no right to take tax money from Peter and give it to Paul. He wouldn't have no right to take tax money from you and give it to me, or from me and give it to you, and certainly not from the entire populace and give it to the Detroit auto manufacturers or the steel manufacturers or whoever it is. So this just couldn't possibly occur under a limited government because the limited government's functions would not be covered by giving welfare to anyone, not the poor people, not the rich people, not anyone. The only thing that the government funds would go for would be armies to protect us, police to protect us, and courts to determine who the good guys and the bad guys are. So that would sort of be ruled out of court. It would be entirely outside of the realm of possibility, given this vision of limited government. Let me just say a word about the poor people, people on welfare, mm-hmm. Who not, you see, right now, even a lot of people are against crony capitalism. A lot of people are against the welfare for corporations, for big corporations, for farmers to pay not to grow food and all that. But they have a sort of a sympathy for, well, let's give money to the poor people.
Sure.
And not what's usually called the able-bodied poor. If you're able-bodied, you get out and work. You don't get welfare. But there are widows and orphans and children and sick people. And the way the libertarian vision would deal with that would be, first of all, we would take away a lot of government which impoverishes people. And if government weren't so busy impoverishing people, maybe there'd be fewer poor people. And the second way would be the private charity. If anyone is falling through the cracks, Americans are very generous people. Even when government is giving money hand over fist to poor people, still private charity is among the most generous in the world. Let me give you a few examples of how government action impoverishes the poor, and then I'll get into that other edge of my double-edged sword about how we can stop the bad guys from exploiting us.
Certainly.
With regard to welfare, the key element to understand about welfare is family formation. There are virtually no poor people from intact families. Poverty is almost entirely a function of non-intact families. So now you have to ask, well, what causes intact families and what causes families to break up or maybe to never form in the first place? And let me tell you the story about the frog. If you put a frog in boiling water, its metabolism is such that it knows, and I put quotes around the word knows, it knows to get out of that water because boiling water is unhappy, very bad for a frog, and it just jumps out. But if you put a frog in cold water and then you heat it up slowly until it boils, its metabolism is not sufficient to tell the difference between marginal changes in temperature, so it stays in there and gets boiled. Well, what's this got to do with poverty? What's this got to do with poverty is that slavery was like boiling water for the black family. And I pick on black families because they're disproportionately poor, or black people are disproportionately poor. So the poverty problem in some sense is a quasi-black problem, so to speak. And the idea here is that you'd think that slavery, I mean, you can hardly come up with a worse abomination than slavery, and yet it was not powerful enough to break up the black family in the long haul. Now, of course, during slavery, one slave was sold here, another slave was sold there. And there's this movie Django or Django Unchained, something like that, which in a very dramatic way illustrates this. But after slavery was over in 1865, what you had was in newspapers and underground talking. We didn't have the web then and email, but people talked. And there'd be messages, John, here I am. Where are you? This is your wife, Sally, or vice versa. Sally, here I am. Where are you, John? And people would get together, even if, you know, one was sold to in Louisiana. Well, if the husband was in South Carolina and the wife was in Louisiana, they would get together. My research in the 1910 census was that the rate of black family formation was just about as good as the rate of white family formation. Whites were a percent or two better than blacks in this regard, but in terms of divorce, in terms of family people cohabiting without marriage, or the father leaving, it was about the same. Namely, slavery paradoxically did not break up the black family. And yet, if you transfer forward into the future, namely into the present now, what is it? 75% of black kids are now being brought up in non-intact families? How did this happen? Mm-hmm. Well, the reason it happened was because of not the boiling water, but the slowly heating water, and that's the welfare system, namely the very system that our friends on the left and the liberals and the socialists and the commies and all those people are saying we must have. That's the thing that broke up the black family, and that's the thing that creates poverty for them. And that's why I say that the government should get out of the business of creating poverty. That would be the best way to stop poverty, get the government to stop creating it. How does this work? Well, up until 1965, when Johnson started in with his Great Society and welfare really took off, it was a disgrace. It was a shame for a young girl to be pregnant without a husband. And if she was, she'd have to go off to Aunt Tilly or Aunt Millie, because this is a disgrace, and have the baby and put it up for adoption. Then she could come back and all would be well. Nowadays, you have classes in high school for girls with babies who are unwed mothers.
Yeah.
So it was a sociological disgrace to do this. But the welfare system made an offer to a black girl, or to any girl. The same thing occurs in Sweden, where there are mostly white people, and yet they have welfare, and you have the breakup of the family there. And it's also breaking up the white family in this country. So it's not a white-black thing. Welfare sure. breaks up families. It just hurts blacks more because they're poorer. So what happens is that the welfare system makes the girl who's pregnant an offer that cannot be matched by the presumed father of a child. It gives her welfare benefits. It gives her food stamps. It gives her housing. It gives her medical care. It gives her everything under the sun, provided that there's no, quote, man in the house, unquote. And the welfare people would go around and make sure that there's nobody supporting her, otherwise she's not entitled to welfare. So what happened is that the whole sociology of being pregnant without a husband changed. And now people are proud of this. Well, look, I'm not saying that this is good or bad. I'm just an economist here, and I'm trying to say that it broke up the black family.
So there's an incentive in this kind of behavior, what you're saying. Now, is that just an unfortunate side effect of this kind of policy, or is there something else going on there, do you think?
Well, according to Cloward and Piven, this was purposeful in order right. to keep the black people down. I'm not sure I fully subscribe to that, but I think it's an interesting thought. But whether it was purposefully done or done as an unintended consequence, it really doesn't matter. The point is that what creates poverty is the breakup of the family, and what breaks up families is welfare. So don't tell me that welfare is a way of helping people.
Yeah.
Welfare is a way of undermining people. Let me give you just one more example of that, which is now in the news about unemployment insurance. The more you pay for X, the more you'll get of it. If I ask you, do you want to be a garbage man? You'll probably say no. But if I say, look, garbage men get paid $3 million a year, you're going to think twice about, well, maybe being a garbage man isn't so bad. Well, it's the same thing with unemployment insurance. The more we pay for unemployment insurance, the more we'll have of unemployment. Look, suppose we went the opposite way and had a, not that I advocate this, but had a death penalty for unemployment. You're unemployed? Oh, okay, we'll shoot you. Do you think we'd have any unemployment in this country? No. Again, I'm not advocating that, but I am saying that if you subsidize something, you get more of it. If you penalize it, you get less of it. And we are subsidizing unemployment. So, of course, we're going to get more unemployment. In Greece, they had very, very generous unemployment benefits, and we saw what happened there. And the U.S. seems to be marching in the Greek direction.
Yeah.
Okay, so I've given you two examples of how government creates poverty. Another one is the minimum wage. It just unemploys unskilled workers. So the government is going around here, there, and everywhere impoverishing people. And then it's saying, well, we're the only ones that can solve it. No, you're not the only ones that can solve it. You're the ones who cause it. It's sort of like pouring, what is it, gasoline on a fire
right.
in an attempt to stop the fire. Okay, so that's the first edge of my double-edged sword.
Let me ask you something before we jump to the next point then, Walter.
Sure.
Yeah. So while on the topic of jobs, let me just ask you that then. Okay. So everyone is, let's say, not capable of just kind of, you know, making their own job. In other words, creating their own company or set something up like that. So they are dependent on other people employing them in that regard. Now, I've heard claims that, you know, it's up to the government to create jobs. How could jobs, let's say, if we're in the environment that we're in right now, how could jobs be created, let's say, under a free market, as opposed to how it is today? Or let's say that the government goes out and say, all right, we're going to create, you know, 1,000 more positions within, you know, this branch of government or whatever, you know, like they're doing today, right?
Well, the government could create jobs. They did it in the Soviet Union. Everyone was employed by the government in the Soviet Union. Wasn't that great?
No, it was not great.
It wasn't so great, but everyone was employed.
Right, right.
The idea, Henry Hazlitt reminds us, is that we don't want jobs. What we want is the things that make that we get from jobs. Namely, we want the goods and services that jobs created. Look, suppose I don doffed, I'm not sure, my Keynesian hat, and I now, I'm the government, I'm the president, we're kicking Obama out, it's President Block, and I'm going to create jobs. And the jobs are digging holes in the ground and then filling up again. Okay, anyone who's unemployed, no more unemployment insurance for you, because we got a job for you. You're going to dig holes in the ground and fill them up again. And at the end of the day, and let's say not just the unemployed people, but everybody has a job doing that. Would that be good? No, we'd all die because we'd have no food. We'd have no doctors. We'd have no clothing, no nothing. Namely, what we want from employment is not employment. Employment is a bad thing. Employment is sort of a waste. It's unfortunate we're not in the Garden of Eden. From the Garden of Eden, we wouldn't need jobs. We could all play and enjoy ourselves. We could, but in back to reality, the reason we want jobs is not for the jobs themselves, it's for what they create. So the key is not to have the government create jobs, but to have the government stop uncreating jobs or destroying jobs. Let me talk about the minimum wage law a little bit. Right now, the minimum wage law is $7.25 an hour. And they're thinking of raising it to 9 or 10, and some of the more radical people want to raise it to 15.
Yeah, I've heard that. Did you hear about the, was it one who got in Seattle? She wanted to raise all the, she was a city council, I think, on there or something. She wanted to raise all the fast food joints to $15 an hour. Well, I mean, all those jobs would go out the window the next day if that was the case.
Well, not all of them, just 95% of them. Don't exaggerate.
Right.
The minimum wage law is not a job creation law. The minimum wage on its face is a job destroying law, because the minimum wage law doesn't say thou shalt employ somebody. It just says thou shalt not employ somebody. And who should you not employ? It says you shouldn't employ anyone unless you pay him $7.25 an hour. But look, suppose my productivity is only $5 an hour. Namely, if you add me to your shop floor or to your factory, your receipts go up by $5 an hour. If you have to pay me $7.25 an hour, you're going to lose $2.25 an hour on me. And if you do that once too often, you're going to go broke. So at one fell swoop, when we have a minimum wage law of $7.25, everyone whose productivity is less than $7.25 is already unemployed. If you raise it to 9, then the people whose productivity is between $7.25 and $8.99 or 9, they're going to be added to the unemployment rolls. Namely, the minimum wage law doesn't raise anyone's productivity. Productivity comes from within ourselves, namely how much human capital we have, how smart we are, how fast we work, how smart we work, how much capital equipment we have to work with, how organized is the society. That's what determines marginal revenue product or productivity. Minimum wage law doesn't change that. All it does is it See, a lot of people, all it does is it just unemploys people who have lower productivity. See, a lot of people, when they think of the minimum wage law, they think of a floor under wages.
Yeah.
And it's a rising floor, and as the floor rises, wages rise. No. That's not the right metaphor to use. If you want to use a better metaphor, think of hurdles. You know the hurdles, the 100-yard hurdles, when you, every 10 yards, I got a hurdle you have to jump over?
Yeah.
Think of the minimum wage law as a hurdle. And the higher the hurdle, the harder it is to jump over it. And and when they keep raising it, if they raise it to 15, then anyone with a productivity of $14 an hour, who right now can be easily employed, is going to lose his job. And if the minimum wage law was so good, why don't we raise it from 15 to 50? Or maybe to 100,000 an hour? Wouldn't that be great?
Right, yeah.
Everyone makes 100,000 an hour. Well, nobody's worth $100,000 an hour. Well, maybe Elvis or, I don't know, Britney Spears or somebody like that. They'd be the only ones employed, or it'd be hard to see how they could work for anyone because we'd all have no money. But that's another point. Another reductio ad absurdum of the minimum wage law is every summer around, April, May, June, there goes out a message from the government, employ teenagers, please employ high school kids. They're on summer break. They need a job. If they don't have a job, they're going to be bored and they'll get into trouble. You know, they're only 16 or 17. And you know what these geniuses have come up with? They've come up with a teenage minimum wage law. Mm-hmm. What's the teenage minimum wage law? Teenage minimum wage law varies in state to state, but it's much less than minimum wage. It could be $2, $3, $4 an hour, $5 an hour. Namely, they're showing some good economic sense. They're realizing that at $7.25, these teenagers are going to be priced out of the market. Whereas at $2 or $3 an hour, some of them won't be priced out of the market. But in making this economic sense, what they're saying, they're conceding the whole point. Namely, if minimum wage law was like a floor, then it would be cruel and unusual punishment to teenagers to get them the only, pay $4 an hour. But the reality is that if it's lowered, then a kid with $5 an hour productivity can get a job at a $4 an hour minimum wage. So the minimum wage law is not an employment law. It creates unemployment. And it attacks the weakest economic actors in the whole society, namely teenagers. Before the advent of the minimum wage, the unemployment rates of teenagers and adults was about the same. The unemployment rate of whites and blacks was about the same. Now, with the minimum wage law, you see, only certain people can jump over these hoops or hurdles better than other people. Now the white unemployment rate is half the black unemployment rate because whites can jump over it better because of all sorts of vestiges of poverty and slavery and other explanations. And also adults can jump over these hurdles, the minimum wage hurdle, much better than teenagers because they have more job experience. So the white unemployment rate is half the black, or the black is twice the white, and the teenage unemployment is twice the adult. So when you get black teenagers, it's quadruple. So if the unemployment rate of whites is 10%, for blacks it's 20%, and for black teenagers it's 40%. And even that's an underestimate because of this discouraged worker phenomenon, namely they only count you as unemployed if you're still looking for a job. But suppose you've been looking for a job for 5 years and you haven't found one. Well, then you're not in a labor force because you're not looking anymore. And if you're not a labor force, you can't be unemployed. So the unemployment rate is artificially reduced. So I would estimate that, I don't know, 50-60% of black kids are unemployed. And it's amazing that so few of them go into crime because they're sort of pushed into it by the horrible, vicious minimum wage law. Now, you might ask, well, if it's so bad, why do we have it?
Right.
And the answer is unions, who are also seen as the be-all and end-all by our friends on the left.
Yep.
And you see, the thing is, when a union wants to raise its wage from, $20 to $25 an hour, what's the first thing the employer thinks of? The first thing the employer thinks of is, hey, one of the factors of production is now suddenly more expensive. Let me see if I can substitute out of this and into a cheaper one.
Yeah.
Very, very similar, like if you were making rowboats, and you can make rowboats out of wood or plastic or metal, and I tell you that the price of wood just doubled, well, you're going to make fewer wooden rowboats and more plastic and metal rowboats. It's just common sense. When the price of something goes up, demand curves slope downward, and you buy less of it. So here the union wants a raise from 20 to 25 an hour, way above the minimum wage. And the first thing the employer thinks of is, well, let me see if I can hire some cheap workers. Because there's more than one way to skin a cat. There's more than one way to make a rowboat. You can make a rowboat with half skilled and half unskilled, or you can make it with 3/4 unskilled and 1/4 skilled. And the skilled workers now are like the foreman for the unskilled workers. We don't have fixed proportions in labor or in production. You can have different proportions of factors and get the same amount of rowboats. So the first thing that the employer wants to do is to hire unskilled workers or relatively unskilled workers and make the skilled workers, the ones that they don't fire, their foreman. The union doesn't think too much of this. And what happens when the first few kids come in, they engage in what I call hate speech. And it's not the N word or the K word. It's the scab word, the S word, the scab. They call them scabs. Mm. And But the problem with that, and then they try to beat them up and slash their tires. But the problem with beating up scabs is it's so blue collarish, you know, and the scabs fight back, and it doesn't look good, you know, for white unions to be beating up black kids, disproportionately black kids. So they came up with this ingenious, vicious, immoral, depraved way of beating up scabs. And you know what that is?
No.
Called the minimum wage law.
Right, right.
Namely, they don't have to beat them up. They just have to get a law passed that makes it disincentivizes the employer from hiring in the first place. So if the employer wants to hire them at $7 an hour, they say, hey, we've got to make the minimum wage 11. And very few of these kids are worth 11, so that the employer won't hire them and has to employ the union at the higher wage rate and can't fire them. So that's why we have it. And I just want to get in one last point on this. What should we do about this? What should we do about the people who perpetrated the minimum wage law on us? Well, to me, it seems like a crime. Look, suppose I were to go to the inner city with a gun and say, okay, you 19 kids, you can't work, but you 20th kid will raise your wage slightly. What would happen to me? I'd be considered the criminal that I am. And yet that's exactly what the minimum wage law does, even though it does it under cover of under color of authority from the government. I think that when we have a libertarian Nuremberg trial, the people who voted for that, the politicians who promulgated it, the police who uphold it, they should all be put in the dock, and then let's see what kind of punishment we mete out to them, because this is a pretty nasty kind of an act to have a minimum wage law.
Well, I mean, I see this kind of thing in Sweden all the time as well. Obviously, this has been going for a long time, how the relationship between the unions and the employer, and it's, I mean, it's, consequently, it's, if it's very difficult to employ as it is, it's also going to be difficult to, you know, to fire. A consequence of this, you see wage, you know, fixing. You cannot actually negotiate your own salary with your boss over a certain level, for example, because this is handled through, you know, the unions. And you know, you'd think that security would be to go get, to be able to go get a job at any place on that same day. And you know that, okay, you know, it might be a crappy job, but at least I can go get it. I know that I'm going to get paid at the end of the day. All of this have kind of been removed from the, from that sphere within how things are run in Sweden, for example. So it's excruciatingly difficult to get employed, for example. And this is one of the downsides. So it's, I mean, some of the things you've mentioned already, you can clearly see this kind of mirroring effect that the intention is to go out and set, you know, something in action, but usually the opposite is actually what comes out of those situations. Isn't that curious how that goes?
Well, there's even a word for an economist. It's called unintended consequences, although in my case, it's not always unintended,
yeah,
as in the case of the unions. They intend that. Maybe not the rank and file unionists who don't know any better, but surely they're economists who are employed by unions, who got a PhD in economics. They ought to know this.
Yeah, yeah. Now, before we continue to that other wedge issue, we still didn't get to that, you know, how we can stop the bad guys. But before we do that, let me ask you about this in terms of wealth inequality then, because there's this very nice trick going around in terms of statistics right now regarding, you know, who's poor, who has money, etc. And there's quite a few videos on YouTube going around about this as well. Some of our listeners sent us some of this. And what I realized as well is that when you look into some of the work of, for example, Thomas Sowell, who talked about, you know, following actually flesh and blood human being over time, as opposed to following the numbers, you realize that people actually move out of, you know, poverty quite a bit, as opposed to this perception that there is a constant, rigid, set poor class, if you will, that's always there. According to his work, Thomas Sowell, there's actually quite a bit of, you know, movement within these different fields, right? So maybe, can you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, yeah, I'm a big fan of Thomas Sowell and Walter Williams, a buddy of his and a buddy of mine. I'm honored that I'm a co-author of an article with Walter Williams, and I edited a book that has an article by Thomas Sowell and Walter Williams in it. I'm a big, big fan of theirs, even though, and they are very, very courageous because, you know, they're called Oreo cookies.
Sure, yeah.
Black on the outside, white on the inside, because somehow all black people have to be socialists. Don't ask me why. And these guys are not socialists, whatever
right.
else they are.
Yeah.
Sowell is absolutely correct. If you look at a flash point or a flashlight or whatever it is, a point in time, there are quintiles or deciles or however you want to put it. But if you look at it over time, time series, people from the there's circulation, not total circulation, but there is some circulation. But look, suppose there weren't. suppose nobody in the lowest quintile ever got up to the second lowest quintile, and nobody from the higher quintile ever got into the second lowest quintile. So what? Why should we all be equal? What's this equality nonsense? Look, we're not equal in many different ways.
Yeah.
I live in New Orleans, and I attended the basketball game of the Pelicans, and I saw a football game, the Saints. Those guys aren't equal to me or to you in terms of ability to dunk a ball or ability to catch a 40-yard pass or anything like that. Those guys are in the top 1% of athletic ability. And there's no way that you or I hope. I hope you're not a professional athlete.
I'm not. No,
I'm not insulting you, but you and I are not professional basketball, football, soccer players, or whatever. And if you looked at the inequality of athletic ability, it's gigantic. I mean, we're going to have a marathon in Rock and Roll Marathon in New Orleans soon, and they had the Boston Marathon. God forbid there were people killed there. Do you know what the difference in time between the winner of the marathon and the guy who comes in last is?
I have no idea.
It's not equal. The winners can do a marathon in 2 hours and 2 minutes or something like that, or 2 hours and 5 minutes. I forget what the world record is. If you do a marathon in 3 hours, you're pretty good in my books, and 4 hours and 5 hours isn't too bad. And there are people that take 7 or 8 or 10 hours to do a marathon or longer. Look at the vast inequality of marathon running.
Well, it's I think the government should do something about that.
Absolutely. Government's got to get in there. And there was this guy, Kurt Vonnegut, who had the Monkey's House, something like that. And what he did is he had a short story where the government did get in there. And what we got to do is take all those guys from Kenya and Africa who are in the lead pack. And what we've got to do is give them 100-pound boots. Maybe 200-pound boots. Each boot should weigh. Then I could beat them, maybe. I don't know. Maybe they beat me, but that would be more equal. And give me a little scooter or something, a motorized scooter to stay up with those guys. Now, that's the way to have equality. Why should we have equality? What's so great about equality? Whether it's equality in money or equality in athletic ability. By the way, I'm bald. I'm follically challenged. I don't know how much hair you've got. I can't see you, but you might have more than me, so you should give me some of your hair follicles, right? Because I'm follically challenged. I'm in the lowest quintile in terms of hair.
Yeah.
And this is unfair, and there's no circulation. I'm not getting up into the second highest quintile in terms of hair. And there are people that have a full head of hair. Is that fair? Absolutely not. The government's got to step in this hair market and make it more equal. And we're so unequal in so many, many other ways. Chess players. This guy, I think he's from Sweden or Denmark, somewhere out there. He, a young kid, Swedish, Norwegian, something like that. He just beat the Indian guy in chess. He's a grandmaster in chess. I play chess. I have a rating of about 1600. That guy could probably beat me without a queen and without two rooks. Is that fair? No. The government's got to make chess more equal. Now, obviously, when you try reductio ad absurdum like this with hair follicles and athletic ability, chess ability, it just sounds silly. But it's also silly with regard to wealth. That is wealth honestly earned by producing stuff and not dishonestly earned by political chicanery. I'm not talking about protecting that kind of wealth. I think that's just stolen property. So I agree with Thomas Sowell, but I go further than him, although probably he's done this too in other articles. Even if there were no circulation, which he shows there is, so bloody what? Look, right nowadays, the poor, most of the poor, they got a color TV, they got air conditioning in New Orleans, they might not have it up in Montana, but they don't need it there. They've got a little car, they got a color TV, they've got, a dishwasher, a refrigerator, all sorts of stuff. Not that I'm saying that they have an enviable position because the government pushes them down. They'd be much richer in a free enterprise society. But just because there's inequality doesn't mean that there's any inequity. People confuse equity with equality. Chess equity would be we can all play chess about the same, which is just silly.
Well, exactly. I mean, I like the differences. I don't have a problem with that at all. I think it would be a horrendously not only boring, but a nightmarish world if this kind of homogenization occurred where everyone indeed were equal, some kind of THX, you know, dystopian future, whatever. But what do you think would actually happen to, let's say, productivity or the way that people work or can at least ideally then have the opportunity to work today, that, you know, if you do want to attain more, you have a possibility of doing that within as it exists today. But what do you think would happen if we set that kind of ceiling on it, if you will, that it was like, all right, no one's going to attain anything more than anyone else. And no matter how hard you work, you're not going to get more than anyone else. What would happen in a world like that, do you think?
Well, we have examples. There's Hollande from France, and then there's this actor, big guy.
Exactly. He went to Russia now because he didn't want to pay all the taxes in France there.
I think his name is Depardieu, the actor.
Yeah, Gérard Depardieu. That's right. Yeah.
He was in France and he moved to Belgium or Russia.
To Russia, yeah.
Well, Russia's more free enterprise than France in this regard.
Wow.
That's what happens. Sweden, you were talking about Sweden. There was a guy, Bjorn Borg, who was a tennis player in the 80s or 90s. And they had a marginal tax rate in Sweden of 110%, which means that if Bjorn Borg went into another tennis tournament and he won $1 million, they would tax him $1,100,000.
Yeah, it's the same thing. I got to mention that Astrid Lindgren, the famous children author, wrote Pippi Longstocking. She was actually taxed 102% of her income at some point there.
Well, I imagine she moved somewhere else.
No, she was a staunch social democrat. She lived in Sweden all her life. She loved it. It's great.
Good girl, good girl. Well, we should raise her taxes a little bit more. This time she makes a million, we should tax it 2 million. And if she still stays, we'd tax it 3 million.
Yeah.
We'll show her. They didn't go far enough. So that's one thing that happens is people go to another country. Another thing is they stop working as hard. They say,
let's take that example then, because I know plenty of young Swedish entrepreneurs who've actually gone to other parts of the world in England. They've gone, you know, to London. They go to other parts of the world too, because they've realized that whatever they do, they can't, I mean, there's nothing for them there in that regard. And let's say that they are they have that ability. They're a genius in some way. They're an inventor. They've come up with something, and yet at the same time, then the fruits of their labor, if that would to really go out in the world, would benefit everybody. The products that are invented by people like this, it's something that's, you know, great. That I think, but in this case, they flee, and those business opportunities and potential people that could be employed by a company that starts up like that is something that never happened within Sweden, for example. So they end up losing on all those opportunities, right?
Absolutely. And even if they don't leave, they produce less, and we have less of the benefits of their genius. And it's so unfair. It's theft. I mean, why should we penalize people like that? Ayn Rand had this magnificent book, Atlas Shrugged, where John Galt was a fictional character who was inventing some wonderful things, and he worked for a company that had this rule that you have to share, and he left, or he stopped working on his motor. That's a very good fictional depiction of this, but so there are utilitarian reasons for not doing it, namely we're poor, we're all poor for the lack of the contributions of these people. And it's unfair. Deontologically, it's just a violation of rights. Suppose a poor man raped a rich woman, and his defense is, well, I'm poor. That fits. She is rich. He's poor. She owes him something, maybe the use of her body. Why not? It's the same principle. I mean, if you take some people say that these taxes are really akin to slavery. Well, that might be an exaggeration, but there is something to be said for that, because, you know, if you take away a person's labor, that's slavery. And if you take away the fruits of their labor, well, that's quasi-slavery at least. So this is just a horrible thing. And this egalitarianism is nonsense. It's got to be stopped. It's unjust, and it doesn't work.
Yeah, I fear that it's shutting down those processes within, you know, those few people who have that ability to come up with the exceptional or extraordinary. I mean, I know that's a very bad state at this stage in the U.S., for example, but I've made that comparison a while ago in terms of someone like, the Apple inventor, Steve Jobs. Like, imagine him coming out of, a country like Sweden. That would never happen, you know? It's like, it wouldn't be the case. And it's very unfortunate, because I think that there are those, you know, human beings that have those capabilities to that extent. But what has happened instead is that you know, they try to tear those, you know, human beings down instead and make them equal. And that is a tremendous disadvantage to everybody at the end. And that's why I don't really realize why they have that kind of reasoning, because the fruits of their labor, again, as I said, is something that would actually benefit everybody, right? But that's
absolutely
that concept is just not there, you know?
The new mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio, I think I'm pronouncing it right, is a person who believes in egalitarianism. And he says there are two different cities, the rich and the poor. Well, when he gets in there, I expect that the rich will leave. And that's roughly what happened to Detroit. Detroit was taxing, and there was white flight, and there were fewer rich people to pay the poor people. So I predict that if Bill de Blasio stays in there for 8 years and implements his policies, New York City will follow Detroit.
All right. Well, we have much more to talk about, and we actually have yet to come to that point because we have so much to talk about here, but how we can basically, you know, stop the quote-unquote bad guys. We'll get to that point in the second segment as we continue here, but I want to give out some of the websites where people can find, you know, more of your writing. You have a number of books, you know, publications out there. Please give out all the details that you want to so our listeners can find your work, Walter.
Well, I have two new books, Defending the Undefendable 2, which is a follow-up to my Defending the Undefendable 1, and a new book on blackmail, and a book on Ron Paul, my love letter to Ron Paul. You can get this by Googling me, Walter Block. I'm on Amazon. WalterBlock.com is another way to get to me. I'm also associated with Loyola University New Orleans, and I have several good colleagues who are all free enterprisers. And so if there are students out there who are listening, or parents or grandparents, come on down to Loyola. I'm also associated with Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama. Go to Mises.com and you'll find a lot of my stuff there as well.
All right, very good. WalterBlock.com, Mises.org as well. We'll have these linked up there, and we have some links to the books as well up there, so check that out. All right, stay with us, everybody. We'll be right back with more.
United forever in friendship and labor, our mighty republics will ever endure. The great Soviet Union will live through the ages, the dream of a people, their fortress secure. Long live our Soviet motherland, built by the people's mighty hand. Long live her people, united and free, strong in a friendship tried by fire. Long may our crimson flag inspire, shining in glory for all men to see. Through days dark and stormy, while great Lenin led us, our eyes saw the bright sun of freedom above. And Stalin, our leader, with faith in the people, inspired us to build up a land that we love. Future destroyed the invader and brought to our homeland the laurels of fame. A glory will live in the memory of nations, and all generations will honor her name. Long live our Soviet motherland, built by the people's mighty hand. Long live her people, united and free, strong in a friendship tried by fire. Long may our crimson flag inspire, shining in glory for all men to see. the people's mighty hand. Long live our people, united and free, strong in our friendship pride by fire. Long may our crimson flag inspire, shining in glory for all men to see.
We are going to carry on in our members section now with Walter Block. More is coming up for subscribers. Sign up for only the price of 2 cups of coffee per month. You will get full access to our archives with coming up soon here on 800 radio programs on all kinds of topics. At the same time, you help to support our broadcast so that we can continue to bring you this service free from commercial interruptions, and we can spare you from blinking ads on the website. Pretty good deal, right? RedIceMembers.com, that's where to go. We have some great shows coming up, by the way. Rick Falkvinge from the Pirate Bay to talk about civil liberties, online privacy, and the Pirate Bay founder who was put in solitary confinement recently in Denmark. We have Dan Fogler, Richard Dewhurst, Ben Davidson, Robert Felix, Sophia Smallstorm, and John King. Stay with us, guys. We have much more to come, an hour or two after the break.